Hi, you're listening to KGOU's special coverage of the start of the 2016 legislative session. I'm Jacob McClelland. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon will address lawmakers and citizens in about half an hour when she delivers her annual State of the State address. Oklahoma's legislative session begins today, and the House and Senate will be dealing with a large budget shortfall, cuts to state agencies, and a teacher shortage. For the next 30 minutes, we'll preview the upcoming session with State Representative Emily Virgin, a Democrat from Norman, Republican State Senator David Holt of Oklahoma City, and University of Oklahoma political scientist Keith Gaddy. Well, let's start a little bit with the budget problems facing the legislature this session. Are there a few options available for lawmakers right now? Ending tax credits and other economic incentives, or ending or putting a pause to income tax cuts, budget cuts for agencies, revenue generation. Am I missing any other options here?
No, we've got a $900 million shortfall, and potentially as high as $1.4 billion. We'll know that in the coming weeks. And you've only got, as you kind of indicated, so many buckets. I mean, if you really you break it down, I mean, there's no new ideas, you know, that we know where the sources of the solution will come from. There's the idea of tax increases. I would say that's probably not going to happen, but, you know, for the sake of completeness, that is one of the options. There's the option of reforming the tax code. That's a little different. I don't think that's what most people would consider a tax increase, but it would bring in more revenue. And that's a $2 billion pie of tax preferences, including credits that most people talk about. But there's also deductions and rebates and exemptions. There's a local and state sales tax deduction that costs us $80 million a year. I mean, there's lots of stuff like that that's going to be an interesting discussion. We're going to really in the weeds this year on tax policy. And then, of course, there's major cuts. That's probably going to be a component of it, too. But I think that the tolerance for cuts to common education, which is a third of the budget, and education is half the budget, you know, that tolerance is wearing thin. And if you don't cut those items, though, you put a pretty big burden on everything else, which, as it turns out, people like some of that other stuff, too. Part of that cutting discussion is also going to open up a discussion about how much of the budget already goes to things that we don't have any discretion over. Because the total state budget is actually $24 billion, and I can't say this enough. And I'm really pleased that last year's budget bill actually totaled that for the first time. Because historically, the media and everybody else talks about a $6 or $7 billion budget as if that is what the state spends. But we were leaving out of the conversation, three quarters of the budget. And so now I think there's going to be a lot more talk about that and the possibility of bringing some of that back into the conversation, you know, taking away some of these, what you could use a million different terms, earmarks, apportions, whatever you want. But there's these ways that over the years we have prioritized things and we've decided that they should go directly to something. And therefore, we've taken them out of the pie that the legislature looks at every year. That's a version of cutting. That's a two-step process towards cutting, because you got to first bring it back into the appropriations process, and then obviously you have to cut it. I mean, if you don't cut it, then it's not all that controversial. But that's going to be a conversation that's going to be part of this budget too. But those are all sort of the mechanisms by which we can deal with this. But everything will be on the table because the size of the hole is so massive.
Well, let's talk a little bit about tax incentives. I mean, we know that the Incentive Evaluation Commission that was established last year to review incentives still hasn't come out or still hasn't listed the incentives to review first. Is there some concern that tax incentives won't be looked at this year?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that every year that I've been there, and this will be my sixth session, every year that I've been there, we've talked about tax credits and which ones that we can get rid of, which ones we can put a cap on, things like that. But every year, as Senator Holt knows, every year the constituency of that tax credit comes to the Capitol and says, we can't live without that tax credit. And then it becomes really tough to get rid of that tax credit. But I think that because this is a situation that we haven't faced in a really long time with a budget shortfall this large, the will to get rid of some of those and bring some of that money back into the budget is going to be greater than before.
The opportunity presented by this crisis is to be more efficient. We are a low tax state overall. You know, the individual different methods by which we get revenue, we can talk about where they rank nationally. But when you put it all together, we are a low tax state. But Oklahomans have generally demonstrated that they like it that way. But you can't be a low tax state and an inefficient one. And we are clearly right. Both. You know, we have too many school districts. We have, you know, we're sitting in one of the greatest, if not the best, higher education institution in Oklahoma, but we have too many of those in general. And I could go on and on. I mean, there's lots of things like that. We cannot be inefficient and a low tax state at the same time. And years like this are when we maybe can finally confront some of those issues.
Well, and to Senator Holt's point on inefficiencies, I think this is the year that we'll finally get something done on criminal justice reform and making sure that we aren't spending such an exorbitant amount of money on the correction system. There was a press conference at the Capitol talking about a truly bipartisan. You've got the ACLU and you've got the Right on Crime organization coming together. And so it's finally to the point where we're seeing that that is a huge pot of money that we don't have to be spending, that we can make some changes there and save money, not just this year, but in the long term.
Yeah. And if you want to find a red state that did this, the state of Georgia, which I think we'd agree is a pretty Republican place, undertook similar reform on assets of on aspects of criminal justice reform, including decriminalization and alternative treatment for drug offenders, for nonviolent drug offenders. Everything's got to be on the table. But what we're doing right now, we have the highest incarceration rate in the country, in a country that has the highest incarceration rate in the civilized world. I mean, this is our big growth industry right now, is throwing people in prison.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we got to talk about that, too.
Yeah. And you're both right. The coalition is certainly coming together across the spectrum. Plus, I'd throw in the Oklahoma City Chamber has now gotten really engaged on the issue because of the effect it's having on the Oklahoma County jail issue. So, So to kind of bring it back to, you know, the point of this and how all this relates to the budget, I mean, obviously, we've all got a lot of ideas on how to spend less money, and that will ultimately help us deal with the budget crisis.
So when we're talking about some of these, this off-the-top spending, this spending that doesn't go through the appropriations process, how transparent is that process of where that money is going before it's even brought out? And are there any attempts to improve that transparency?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the budget process as a whole, because you don't just have to talk about off-the-top money when you want to talk about transparency. The budget process as a whole needs to be more transparent. And Senator Holt is right in saying that last year's budget was a step forward in talking about all of the money that actually goes to agencies, because we're just talking about the money that the legislators ourselves get to appropriate. But we're not talking about federal dollars. We're not talking about off the top money. We're not talking about fees and all the other things that agencies generate. But the budget process itself has to be more transparent. And I think the people want that, because right now it's behind closed doors and most legislators get an up or down vote on it and that's it. But the off the top money is certainly a component of that. But as we're sitting at OU, I think it's important to remember that there are some programs like OLAP, Oklahoma's Promise Scholarship Program, that kids sign up for in the eighth grade. And we have to make sure that that money's there when they when they're seniors in high school and getting ready to go to college. So those programs where we're making a promise 4 or 5 years in advance, maybe those are worthy to keep off the top. But there are some that followed after the Oklahoma's Promise program that we probably got carried away with putting those in off-the-top appropriations because they had strong lobbies or any number of reasons.
Your original question being about the transparency of all these off-the-top apportionment, earmarks, whatever you want to call them. I mean, they are, you got two lawyers here, so I'll use this phrase. They are constructively transparent. You know, I mean, you could find out if you wanted to. It's not a real secret, but we certainly do not advertise it well, and we certainly do not present it to the public very well, even to the point where the media, I think, gets confused. And my example of that is simply that for years and years and years, the media reports the passage of the budget, shows the pie chart, you know, shows here's this $7 billion, you know, $100 million to transportation, all that. And I mean, you would be hard-pressed to question that the real budget looks any different than that. But again, until last year, we never talked about all the other money. And so it was kind of a secret. I mean, you had to ask. You know, we certainly didn't tell you about that other money. And that was actually to the whatever party was in power. It was to their detriment in many cases because we were spending a lot more on education and a lot more on roads than it showed in the budget. Because, in fact, those things had been so prioritized, they had been given their direct apportionments and had been left out of the budget process, at which point they stopped getting talked about. They just didn't exist anymore. So I think part of the governing party's job lately has has been to talk about those things as part of a marketing campaign too, to just let you know, hey, by the way, you know, you're knocking us on not spending this money for these things, but actually we do. It's just we already spend it kind of permanently and we don't talk about it anymore. But to the point about transparency, you know, I've talked about this for the last few years. How you would really get to that, I think, is to go to put more focus on the budget and go to a budget-only session every other year. What they did in the Senate this last year was a nice, modest step forward, and I commend the leadership for it. We put every member of the Senate on the Appropriations Committee, and we actually had hearings, public hearings, during session on large agencies that would last, you know, a couple hours. And that may seem like not really a revolutionary thought that you would spend 2 hours discussing a multi-billion dollar agency like DHS, but it was in the history of our organization. You know, we would have a very small hearing of a subcommittee that happens in January that like six people are at, where they would spend 30 minutes talking about DHS and they would move on. We should spend, however, 2 weeks talking about DHS, you know, and every senator ought to be there and we ought to get into the most granular level of discussion about DHS. But to do that would require us stop contemplating thousands of bills every session, because Emily and I have a lot of ideas. We're as much as we care about the budget, we can't resist pushing our legislative ideas. Somebody has to stop us, and that's why I say we need this constitutional amendment to stop us from legislating again and let us focus on the budget every other year. That would be all that we would do, and I think you would see us contemplate problems better, make adjustments better, look at inefficiencies better, think about our savings account, which has obviously completely failed us in this shortfall. All of those issues, I think we would do a better job. We're pretty smart people, but you know, you can only do so much in the limited time that we dedicate it to.
Yeah, and there are states that do this. Alabama has a 20-day budget session that seems to work quite well for them, and they also have 4-year legislative terms for everybody. And if there's a true crisis, something truly comes up, that's what special sessions are for. Right. So you've always got the option of calling a special or even a concurrent special to deal with something that doesn't fall in the purview of the budget in a budget only session year. Mm-hmm. This is actually helping to illuminate one of the challenges in the legislature that this crisis it may help resolve, which is we're going to find out what the stable governing coalitions are in both chambers. We're going to find that the Senate has had the privilege of only having had two leaders for the last 10 years. Yeah. Okay, highly stable leadership. And a relatively stable working environment. The State House, by contrast, is on their 7th speaker in 12 years. Okay, and actually, I think Speaker Hickman may end up being the longest-serving speaker in that stretch, probably the longest-serving speaker since Lloyd Benson, if I go back and I check my math on this. And you know, this is going to force the House to find 51 votes to do things. Or 74 votes to do things, depending on what happens. But we're going to find out where that stable governing coalition is and what it's going to look like. We're going to find out who came to govern. Because right now, the House historically is incapable of being anchored to take any steps on anything hard. Symbolic, yes, but hard, no. The Senate has usually been better situated to do it. This is the time where the gut check occurs. The State House will have to step forward and help the Senate govern. And the governor will have to be there also.
That's asking a lot, Keith.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, David, you should have had me for class. Emily's used to it.
I predict the House will fail a budget 3 to 5 times before we get there.
So, Senator, does that
mean? We just want to make sure.
Yeah. So let me ask you, are we looking at extended session? Do you guys have plans for June?
I can tell you this. No, do not book a vacation in June if you work in or around the Oklahoma legislature. I think that is absolutely right. You're right. It's going to take tough decisions, and people will choose to make an easy decision 3 or 4 times before they will finally give in and make the tough decision.
But that's the thing, is that it shouldn't take us until June to get it done. It's because we save it until the last minute. You know, last session, we didn't hear the budget until the last 2 weeks of session. And we should be doing this the entire time. And so to Senator Holt's point, a budget-only session when we're dealing with a lot of other policy issues that I would not like to be dealing with this session sounds very attractive.
With the importance of the budget this year, do you see this as a session where social issues are going to take a back seat to the budget?
I had hoped so, but after bill filing, it doesn't seem to be the case. There were a lot of pieces of social legislation that were filed. But just because they were filed doesn't necessarily mean that they'll get heard in committee or they'll get heard on either chamber's floor. I hope they won't be heard because, like I said, you know, we've got bills dealing with who gets to go into which public restroom. And that just doesn't seem like a good use of our time when we've got a $1 billion shortfall.
Yeah. She says they won't get heard in committee. They will, however, be heard on The Daily Show.
Right.
On Saturday Night Live. This has become an annual tradition in the Oklahoma legislature. The month or so after filing, where a series of bills that don't seem focused on relevant issues to daily Oklahoma life take the forefront. And so we'll spend this 30 minutes talking about really important issues, but in the coming weeks, it's highly likely that everyone else will be spending their time talking about kind of silly issues before we get to the serious stuff after those bills die.
Let's talk a little bit about your bill, Senator Holt, that would provide $10,000 salary raise for Oklahoma teachers who mm-hmm. haven't received a raise in 7 or 8 years. It's been a long time, and they're well below the national average at this point. You've taken a kind of a three-pronged attack to this. Tell us a little bit about how this proposal works.
Well, I mean, first of all, I want to, you know, explain why one should even go to this effort. I mean, but I think it's a moral obligation to our future. If we want, you know, the future that Oklahoma should want depends on a good education system. A good education system depends on good teachers. Good teachers depends on a competitive salary. And we've just fallen behind. We haven't had a salary raise since 2008. We're several thousand dollars behind the region. We're $10,000 behind the nation. And there is a breaking point, and I think we're there. And it's a very unfortunate, of course, that it's occurring at the same time as a $1 billion shortfall. So you have to get extra creative. But I came forward with a proposal for a $10,000 pay raise on a three-legged stool of basically, and of course, it's funny, we just talked about apportionments, but in here I'm proposing another one. But I would like to apportion, you know, the future growth that will inevitably occur. And in response to the obvious question of, well, if you don't like apportionments, why do you like this one? I think apportionments have a short-term purpose from time to time when there is something that needs to be addressed. And I think in the short term, we have to make a commitment more than just an oral one to teacher pay raises. And we can make a legal commitment that the first $200 million of growth that we have after this bad year will go to teacher pay raises. And so look at it. We're cutting $1 billion in 1 year. $200 million growth in the coming years is not that ambitious. It will happen. Things will turn around.
Would you be willing to put a sunset on that after a number of years?
I'm sure. Yeah. If I could get anything like what I'm describing, I'll take any sort of compromise that could be put on the table. And maybe that's not a bad idea. Maybe that's how all apportionments should work. You know, you set the short-term goal, and then you say you've got to defend it later down the line and by sunsetting it. So that's the first leg of the stool. The second leg is tax reform. A lot of the same stuff I just talked about in relation to the budget, you know, and maybe one of the challenges to my proposal is that we'll use a lot of these ideas to balance the budget before we can use them to give teacher pay raises. But none of those things have been done yet. So here in the January-February time period of 2016, I can still propose them and want to try and use some of those tax reform possibilities as a way to fund a teacher pay raise. So, by the way, just so people know this number, to give a $10,000 raise to 41,000 teachers costs $400 million. So I've got $200 million in new growth, $200 million in tax reform out of a $2 billion pie that I talked about earlier. So I mean, it's not completely outrageous to think that you could shave 10% off of that. And then the third leg of my stool is administrative efficiencies. We have 520 school districts. It's an urban issue as much as a rural one. In fact, my bill calls for the burden to be balanced on both urban and rural communities equally. And it says that not a single school site can be closed. But in Oklahoma City, we have 24 school districts. That's both outrageously inefficient, but it is also a burden on low-income families, I mean, who are highly mobile. Any inner-city school will tell you that their turnover rates are tremendous, and yet so that means we have young people moving around Oklahoma City, not just among schools, but among school districts, which means they have no chance of having a continuous education. If you went to Philadelphia and New York and Chicago and said, hey, on top of the problems you deal with, addressing poverty in schools, would you also like to divide your school district up into 24 school districts? They would say that's ridiculous. Why would you compound the problems of poverty by doing that? But we do that to ourselves. So I always like to talk about that because the administrative efficiency and district merger issue always gets talked about as if it's a rural issue. Look, start in Oklahoma City, start in my community. We've got to have fewer school districts.
Well, and there's history and experience with this and the folding into the Spencer school system, for example. There have been mergers that have occurred in the metro, and we're down a net of 75 school districts in the last 25 years. So there has been some consolidation that's taken place voluntarily in addition to service consolidation and service sharing, especially in the western part of the state. They've been very good at this. Texas has seven times as many people as Oklahoma. They have twice as many school districts. Florida has five times as many people as Oklahoma and has 67 school districts. We don't have to do it this way.
Right. And as I said, can't be inefficient and low tax.
Single biggest problem in the state of Oklahoma. Wonderful place to live, but incrementalism, the argument, well, we always did it that way, so we're going to keep doing it that way. That is no rationale for governing. If it works, yeah, we keep doing things that work, but we keep doing things that don't work. You know, we need to find new ways, and sometimes less is more.
Yeah. So anyways, that's the three-legged stool of how I would fund a $10,000 pay raise. And it's absolutely needed, and I don't care if, you know, people tweak with the ideas or come up with better ones, but I just wanted to lay down the marker that that's how I felt about the issue and that I thought I had come up with something that was actually kind of practical and realistic, and it didn't involve a tax increase, which I think actually made it unrealistic. You know, I don't think that, at least in the atmosphere that Emily and I operate in at the Capitol, we're not going to pass a tax increase. So, you know, whether the voters do that in November is another issue, but that's sort of an alternate reality, and I'm not that I don't operate in, and I can't, you know, sit around and wait for that to happen. I felt a moral obligation to come up with a plan today that could actually be considered in the short term and start to give people some assurance that they would eventually see a pay raise.
You mentioned the alternate, what do you call it, the alternate universe where there's the penny sales tax proposal for education. Representative Virgin, Senator Hull, I mean, what are your thoughts on that proposal or the one that was recently proposed by Dr. Terry Klein for $1.50 increase in the cigarette tax?
The cigarette tax is always an appealing one. People are always willing to tax cigarettes, tax alcohol. The sin taxes are always palatable to the public. But I don't know if the $1.50 cigarette tax gets us where we need to go. And that's why President Boren chose the sales tax. That's why they chose a penny increase, because they wanted to get to a specific dollar amount, and that's how they got to it. You know, the penny sales tax increase is a complicated issue, obviously. And a lot of people are worried that the sales tax is a regressive tax, so it hits low-income people harder than it hits those in the upper classes. But my view is that what also hits low-income people the most is not having a quality education system. And I feel like we're at a crisis point right now, and that something has to be done. I don't want this to be a permanent sales tax increase. Just like Senator Holt said, he doesn't necessarily want it to be a permanent off-the-top apportionment. But I think we'll all agree that in terms of teacher pay, we're at a crisis point. We're losing teachers to every surrounding state. And so I think that this is a good way to do it. I think I commend President Boren for taking a hard stance on it. I hope that the voters pass it in November, but I hope that it starts a larger conversation about our tax structure in Oklahoma, because this would put us at the highest sales tax in the country. And we have municipalities that depend on the sales tax solely. And so I hope that this spurns a larger conversation about why we tax what we do and why we apportion what we do via the essentially three different taxes that we have in Oklahoma.
Senator Holt?
I think the only thing I'd add to that is just, you know, I felt like if you can provide a teacher pay raise without a tax increase, then that's what you should do. And I felt like I demonstrated with my plan that you could.
Now, Representative Virgin, you've introduced the Equal Pay for Women Act, and you've cited that women earn 73.5% as much as men for the same work. How will your bill address this?
Yeah, so not many people know this, but the law in Oklahoma requiring equal pay for women has actually been on the books for over 50 years, but it hasn't been enforced. The penalty was very low. It's not working because women still make 73.5 cents on the dollar. And that's not including minority women. So minority women are much lower. Latino women make 55 cents on the dollar for men, and Native American women and African American women are at 63 to 65 cents. So it's a real issue in Oklahoma, especially because we have 180,000 households in Oklahoma that are headed up by a single mother. And so this is a huge family issue. It's a huge economic issue. And so what this bill does is add to the current law. And what I see it as is a transparency measure. So it's hard for women to know in a private workplace how much their male counterpart makes. And a lot of policy manuals at private employers say you can't talk about your pay with your coworkers. And so what our bill would do is make sure that women can have those conversations and make sure that they're being treated equally. So they wouldn't fear retribution for having the conversation with their male counterpart. And we're hoping to work with the Labor Department. We've had conversations with him about the enforcement of that. And we're also increasing the penalty. It was basically $50 before. And now we're increasing that to $200 per pay period.
How does this differ from the 2009 federal law that was passed addressing the similar thing?
Yeah, it's actually not that much different. The federal law, for whatever reason, hasn't really worked very well because we're still having this problem. And I've been asked that, you know, why are you doing this? Because it's already federal law. I see this more as a state level issue. I think that it's up to the states to try to enforce it. And we have the mechanisms through the Labor Department to do that.
Well, I want to get back a little bit to the budget issues. Our state impact reporter Logan Layden often says that the time to deal with drought is when you're not in the middle of a drought, when you have a lot of water. That's the time to plan for the next drought that's coming up. Now that we're in the middle of a bust in this boom and bust cycle, what do you hope that future legislators will learn from going through this bust cycle the next time that things are going well and energy prices are high?
I tell you what, I'll jump in on this one real quick.
Thank you.
That's okay. You know, part of teaching is facilitating discussion, you know.
Take it away.
Okay. I used to teach budgeting. And, you know, Oklahoma, in the last bust, one thing Oklahoma did is they got out front with what at the time was a very novel, robust rainy day fund program, okay? And then we discovered that there were some loopholes that allowed lawmakers to exploit and abuse the rainy day fund. But, you know, the first lesson is when times are good, you load that thing up, you expand its capacity, and you keep lartering it up. So after we get out of this cycle, what we do is we take a look and see what do we need to do to further stabilize our revenue flows and the ability to hold reserves. But I don't have a lot of faith that those lessons will be learned, because during the last bust, we had been cutting taxes going into that. And then we got creamed, and it took about 3 years to recover. And here we are again. We did the same thing going in. Times were good. We're rolling in money, so we start cutting taxes. We're not saving, and we get creamed again. Dear Lord, give me one more boom, and I promise not to fritter it away, right? The Wildcatter's prayer. We do not learn. I think we'll come out of this, and I think that these two esteemed lawmakers would do something about it. I'm curious to hear what they're willing to do. But I don't think the will is there in the legislature. I think times will get good and everybody will forget.
Well, I think that's why, to Jacob's point, we've got to do it now while it's still fresh and we don't want to ever have to experience this again. And I have a proposal on the table that's gotten some discussion, a favorable editorial in the Oklahoman this week about it. And that is, first of all, let's increase our savings capacity, because it should come as no shock, as Keith says, you know, that we're going to have a boom and bust economy in a state like Oklahoma based on energy prices. And yet, here we are. I mean, you know, the vast majority of the problem causing what we're experiencing today is a result of energy prices. And so I think we need to have a more robust savings account. And I think that the simplest and easiest way to do that is to simply measure it against the total state budget, which we now know to be $24 billion, not $7 billion. And see, we have this rainy day fund, which, as he says, we created and then we tightened it up. And those were all good steps. But we set it against the $5 to $7 billion in general revenue. And that would be like in your household, you decided you wanted to create a savings account for your own rainy day. And you said, let's save 15% of the cable bill. You know, I mean, you need to save 15% of your entire household expenditures. And that is $24 billion. So that's my simple, easy fix for starters. Then you got to fill it. And that's another step. But I think I've heard people even in the energy industry come up to me in the last couple months and say, shouldn't we push some of the gross production tax to the rainy day fund, you know, every year? It doesn't cost them anything else. They don't care how it's spent. Obviously, the counter to that will be people who want to spend that money today. But again, look at what we're going through right now. Do you really want to go through that again? You know, and that's what we'll be able to use this experience to illuminate for people is reminding them whenever they want to fight for these revenues and spend every last dollar, hey, shouldn't we save some of it? Because things are going to be bad. And if you really want to be, you know, forward thinking, what happens when we run out of this stuff here in Oklahoma? You know, I mean, we have no replacement for this energy economy that our state funds depend on so much. So I'd say, yeah, increase the capacity of the rainy day fund. Do it this year. And I would say also do this year. Let's get moving forward on a way to fund the rainy day fund beyond what we already do, because we'll never get what we need, which is probably $3 billion if we keep doing it the way we've been doing it.
Yeah, and I think to add to that point, nobody really likes that we have a boom and bust cycle economy in Oklahoma. And so let's do something about it. Let's make sure that we diversify our economy. And so when energy prices dip like this, we aren't so in a dire situation. And so I think you've seen a lot of that with technology industries, with Boeing coming to Oklahoma, and the governor has been great on trying to attract different industries to Oklahoma. But I think we have to look back at these busts and think, man, I really don't want that to happen again. We can't just accept that it's going to happen. We need to do something about diversifying our economy also.
That was Republican State Senator David Holt from Oklahoma City, Democratic State Representative Emily Virgin of Norman, and University of Oklahoma political scientist Keith Gaddy, previewing Oklahoma's 2016 legislative session. You can find our conversation online on our website, kgou.org. Coming up on KGOU, we'll join Governor Mary Fallon for her annual State of the State address from the Capitol in Oklahoma City. I'm Jacob McClelland. This is KGOU, your NPR source.